We are studying the book of Samuel, and we're on 2 Samuel. We're on page 111. We've finished 1 Samuel, and basically the story of 1 Samuel was from the time of Samuel's turning over his leadership or rule over Israel to their first king, King Saul, and the introduction of who David was and all of the characters and the stories that go with all of that. And it ends with the death of Saul and the emergence of David as the heir apparent. The book of 2 Samuel highlights the 40-year reign of King David over Judah initially from 1011 to 1004 B.C. Remember, working backwards, 7 years, and then over the kingdom of Israel for 33 years, for a total of 40 years. When David has the opportunity to become king, he is wise enough to wait until he is requested rather than try to impose his rule over them. The people of Judah, who are already following anyway, because most of them have been, a lot of them have been with him in exile, but they very quickly grab him up as their king. But he waits 7 years until the people, and we'll study that, but he waits until the people of the north, the other 10 tribes basically, ask him to come and be their king. You know, if it's better to get somebody late and get somewhere late and have them ask where you been than to get there early and have them ask, what are you doing here? His wisdom, you know, comes through, and his humility. The book of 2 Samuel was written down between the time after Solomon's death in 931 and the northern Israel's captivity in 722. So in order to get the full story, we have to include the first two chapters of 1 Kings as the last two chapters of 2 Samuel, which we'll do. The compiler of 2 Samuel uses the writings of Nathan the prophet and Gad the seer. A seer is another name for a prophet. If a prophet receives the messages in visions, he's called a seer. If he receives or she receives it in verbal, they're called an oracle. So Nathan and Gad were the two people attributed to writing this down. They were both spiritual descendants of Samuel. The way that the prophets operated is that they would be surrounded by young disciples, prophets in training, people who wanted to, well, people who just believed in their teaching and were supportive and whatever, small congregation. They were known as the school of the prophets. And remember, there's two kinds of prophets in the Old Testament. There's the non-writing prophets and the writing prophets. And the non-writing prophets would include people like Elijah and Elisha and a number of people who never wrote anything down, but they did a number of famous things. We've talked about that. They raised people from the dead and they prophesied to kings. Their stories mostly told in the historical books of Kings and Chronicles. The writing prophets are the prophets for whom we have books left behind. And these were almost, without exception, written down by their followers, the school of the prophets. Somebody would keep track of what Daddy said, you know, what was said. Very often, of course, these prophecies came, you know, time, and then just more and more. So they were sort of stacks of things that were said by this prophet while they were alive and kicking. And somewhere after they were gone, someone would compile that together, and those compilations became basically the books of the prophets that we read. And so 2 Samuel, 1 Samuel was written most entirely by Samuel while he was alive. 2 Samuel was written largely by Gad and Nathan. The same compilation process was undoubtedly true for Isaiah, Ezekiel, and Jeremiah, and most of the other written prophets. It was also certainly true for Paul, who had Luke as his amanuensis. Amanuensis is a ghostwriter or a scribe. Remember, not many people wrote, or even read for that matter, in the ancient world, even into the first century. And people who wrote, not many of them wrote well. I mean, they could do a laundry list or whatever. But they could write their name, whatever. They could speak Koine Greek. Whether they could read it or not, it's highly dependent on what they had. They could, if the Jewish boys could read Hebrew, some of the girls, because they were taught it when they were taught the Torah, and the Jewish boys had to be able to read Hebrew in order to get bar mitzvah at age 12. But as far as reading and writing, they were scarce. The materials to write on were scarce and expensive. The process of writing needed to be done very efficiently. So people were raised up to do this and do it well. They were known as scribes. And, you know, they would write very neatly, concisely, so as to save the paper, et cetera, et cetera. So you could get about 18,000 characters on a scroll. The scroll would at some point become too big to deal with. And so there's about 18,000 characters on a scroll. And when you got to that, you would have to stop. For instance, the book of Luke and the book of Acts are all one book. They're all written by Luke, and it's just one continuous story. The Gospel of Luke includes the book of Acts. But after about 18,000 characters, they ran out of room on the scroll. And so the end of the book of Luke and the beginning of the book of Acts are almost identical, because they finish the story and then take it up from there. So that's an example of how that worked. Peter had an amanuensis. His name was John Mark. He was the young fellow who wrote the Gospel of Mark. He was the one that Paul and Barnabas had a falling out with when John Mark was a young kid, went on the first missionary journey and backed out because it got tough. And when they got ready to go for the second missionary journey, Barnabas wanted to take him for a second time, and Paul wouldn't have it. So he and Barnabas fell out over it. Barnabas took John Mark, who was his cousin, back to Cyprus from where they were, and discipled him over the years, and eventually turned him over to Peter as he got more older, more mature. Peter found him to be a very delightful and helpful person, and eventually in the epistles, Paul recommends him as well. So they work through that. Jesus, of course, has amanuenses: Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. You know, we have no record that he ever wrote a single thing, and would have been unlikely to do that. All right, 1 Chronicles 29 is where we get this bit of this information. Now, the Acts of King David, from first to last, we're in the middle of page 111. 1 Chronicles 29 says, "Now the Acts of King David, from the first to the last, are written in the Chronicles of Samuel the seer, in the Chronicles of Nathan the prophet, and in the Chronicles of Gad the seer. With all his reign, his power, and circumstances came on him, on Israel, and all the kingdoms on the land." So that's where we get some of that information. David is the only person in the Bible who is designated by God as a man after my own heart. I'm sure God would have said that about some other people. Daniel was a man for whom there is written not one flaw, although I'm sure he was human. Job was a very good man as well. God loved him. But God loved David, and he loved him because David understood relationship. David was very human, and he would sin, and sometimes he committed what we would call big sin. But the thing about David is that when he would be confronted, he would immediately acknowledge his sin and go down on his knees and repent. He'd be prepared to make reparation. He would honestly gladly accept the discipline of the Lord. And he was so focused on his relationship with God that God did not hold his sins against him. Now, there were consequences to his sin. We'll see some of those. There are prices that he and his family paid for some of his sins. There's always consequences. But God did not hold his sin against him when he judged him to be a good or a bad man. If God were going to hold our sins against us and therefore judge us as to whether or not we're acceptable or not, none of us would be acceptable. The Lord is... by his grace has made it so that if we are in a working relationship with him, an honoring relationship with him, a right relationship with him, and if we are in a right relationship with our fellow man, that he will not judge us by our deeds. He will judge us by the works of Jesus. If we don't have those two things going, then he has nothing to judge us on but our deeds. So we could have a church full of religious people who don't really have a working relationship with the Lord, and they'll still have to be judged on their deeds. And the first psalm, David, and he says this a number of times because he knows it's important to him. David is amazed and blessed by the way that God relates to him. He said, "How blessed is the man who does not walk in the counsel of the wicked, nor stand in the path of sinners, nor sit in the seat of scoffers, but his delight is in the law of the Lord. And in his law he meditates day and night. He will be like a tree firmly planted by streams of water, which yields its fruit in season, its leaf does not wither. And whatever he does, he prospers. The wicked are not so, but they are chaff which are driven away, which the wind drives away. Therefore the wicked will not stand in the judgment." They won't make it. "Nor sinners in the assembly of the righteous. They will not be allowed into the assembly. For the Lord knows the way of the righteous, but the way of the wicked will perish." The Bible, on a technical basis, refers to people who are in relationship with God, who are born again, we would say, or walking in relationship with God, as saints. We've historically used the term saint to mean some sort of high and exalted holy person, but that's not what it means at all. It just means a person who's set apart. The word saint comes from the word Latin sanctus, which means where we get the word holy, and that just means set apart. If someone's holy, there's no representation that they're not sin. They have no sin, but they're set apart to God. And so a person who's walking with the Lord is considered a saint. A person who's not is considered a sinner. In 1 John, we get a really good presentation on the issue of sin. And he says some interesting things. He says, first of all, if anybody says they have no sin, they're a liar, because it's just not true. But then he goes on to say that we should not sin. And he says, if we practice sin, that we do not have God in us. So on the one hand, he's saying everybody's got sin, but on the other hand, if we practice sin, we don't have God. And the reason is because he and Peter and Paul, in their writings, make a distinction between a person who has a relationship with God, and in the process of growing in that relationship and becoming more mature, becoming more sanctified, they commit sins occasionally. It sort of flows out of their sanctification process. They commit sin. And what they're saying is that person, God does not hold their sin against them, because he's relating to them on the basis of relationship. It would be kind of like if you have a really good son or daughter, and she messes up from time to time, or he does, but because of they're such a good kid, the relationship is so good, you acknowledge what they did wrong, and then you move on. You don't feel the need to beat them up or put up a wall or put up whatever, because they're trying, they're working at it, and they're going to make mistakes. Sin is sin, but the relationship makes all the difference. On the other hand, they talk about practicing sin. When we know that something's wrong, and we know we're not supposed to be doing it, and we do it anyway, not because we're so much weak, but because we're just stubborn and rebellious, we're just going to do this. We've decided we're going to do this. We know that we're not supposed to sleep together with people with whom we're not married, but we just decide we're going to do this. Well, that's practicing sin. What you're saying is, I know it's wrong, but I'm going to do it anyway. And so what Paul, John, and Peter, and them, when they write, would be telling us is if we practice sin, we don't have God in us. We can't look God in the face and say, I know this wrong, but I'm going to do it anyway. Not because I know it's wrong, but I'm hooked or whatever, and I want it, I confess it's wrong, and I want to repent, and I'm asking your help. Not that. But if we say, well, I'm just going to do it anyway. I don't, frankly, I'm not going to obey you on this. Now, of course, that extends even to people who say, well, there is no God, I'll just do what I darn please. And so to practice sin means to basically shove God's authority out of our life and just go on forward with it. But John says is they don't have any relationship with God at all. It's pure and simple, that's what he says. They don't have God in them. So it's important distinction. Psalm 32, David is talking about the blessedness of God's forgiveness. How blessed is he whose transgression is forgiven, whose sin is covered. How blessed is the man to whom the Lord does not impute iniquity, in whose spirit there is no deceit. How blessed am I if the Lord does not hold my sin against me? Psalm 32. How blessed am I if he does not impute iniquity to me? I'm not on the book. When I kept silent about my sin, my body wasted away through my groaning all day long. For day and night your hand was heavy upon me. My vitality was drained away as with the fever heat of summer. I acknowledged my sin to thee, and my iniquity I did not hide. And I said, I will confess my transgressions to the Lord, and thou didst forgive the guilt of my sin. The thing about our relationship with God is that He not only forgives our sin, but He forgives the guilt of our sin. In other words, we're not meant to live condemned before Him. We're going to mess up. We do that, and we need to be repentant for that. But we don't need to feel shame. Shame is not something that is God-given. And it's something the enemy uses to beat us up with. Therefore, let everyone who is godly pray to pray to thee in a time when thou mayest be found. Surely in the flood of great waters they shall not reach him. Thou art my hiding place. Thou dost preserve me from trouble and surround me from the songs of deliverance. So he's saying, you know, if we will walk with God, then he will be our hiding place. We can hide under him, and he will shelter us from the judgment of the sinner. He says, I will instruct you and teach you in the way you should go. I will counsel you with my eye upon you, the Lord says in response to David. Do not be as the horse or the mule, which have no understanding, whose trappings include the bit and the bridle to hold them in check. Otherwise, I will not come near to you. So, God is wanting us to be responsive to him. And he doesn't want to have to beat us up to get us to do the right thing. Many are the sorrows of the wicked, but he who trusts in the Lord, mercy shall surround him. Loving kindness. The biblical word loving kindness is probably best translated in our world as mercy. Because we don't use that word in English, but it'd be mercy. Be glad in the Lord and rejoice, you who are righteous. Remember, the word righteous means rightly related. It doesn't mean sinless. If the Bible wants to say that someone is sinless, it says that they are sinless. Righteousness, rightly related. And shout for joy, all you who are upright, which is the same word, rightly related, in heart. So, back to page 111. Though his deeds were sometimes sinful and sometimes very sinful, David never abandons his relationship with God. Nothing about this observation gives David or any of us license to sin. David got prosperous and cocky and powerful and seduced by all of that and just drifted in his relationship and wound up committing all kinds of hideous sins between rape and adultery and murder to cover it up, etc. But when Nathan confronted him, he owned it. Even forgiven sin has consequences that do not go away. So if we're a justice-oriented person and we don't think it's fair that God should forgive our sins, especially if they were done against us, you know, I have a different opinion about that, if they're done against me, we can take some comfort in the fact that consequences are consequences. David knows what God values, even when he fails to do God's will. In that sense, David is the perfect role model for we who are fallen. We've already witnessed in David's life how much he honors God and the things of God. We witnessed it, for instance, in the way he treated Saul, who he had on numerous occasions an opportunity to attack and kill, but he didn't because he honored God. The study of David and his life are therefore very valuable for the Christian student of God's Word. His early years especially reflect the nature of Jesus in ways that can inform our faith and our behavior. In 1 Samuel, we have seen that David knows how to depend upon God in the face of giant obstacles, forgive his enemies as an honor to the Lord, and to care for others even at his own expense. The book of 2 Samuel continues the story and develops it over the full expanse of his life and kingdom. The life and times of David are repeated and additional information given in the book of 1 Chronicles. The story of the rest of the kings of Judah and Israel prior to the Babylonian captivity is the subject of 2 Chronicles. 2 Samuel 2, verse 1. Then it came about that afterwards David inquired of the Lord and said, shall I go up to one of the cities of Judah? And the Lord said to him, go up. Now Saul is dead. David is no longer has to be fearful for his life that someone's going to kill him. He's no longer being chased down by the king and all the king's men. So he is saying, "What should I go up somewhere and should I live in Judah again? rather than in the desert. So David said, well, where do you want me to go? And he said, go to Hebron. So David went up there, and his two wives also, Ahinoam the Jezreelitess, and Abigail the widow of Nabal the Carmelite. And David brought up his men who were with him, each with his own household, and they lived in the cities of Hebron. And the men of Judah came, and there anointed David king over the house of Judah. And they told David, saying, it was the men of Jabesh-Gilead who buried Saul. Remember that when Saul was defeated in battle, that he fell on his own sword rather than be captured by his enemy. And his sons were killed, Jonathan and his other son, him, I forget his name right now. They were killed at the same time. And the Philistines cut off their heads and put them on pikes and drove them through the various Philistine cities in tribute to their triumph, and nailed their bodies up against the wall. And the men of Jabesh-Gilead had heard about this, and they marched all night and took the bodies down, took the heads off the pikes, and took them and buried them honorably. The first thing that Saul did as king was to save the men of Jabesh-Gilead, rescue them from their enemies. And they remembered it, so they did this. Now, David has been anointed as Saul's replacement by the prophet Samuel, and at God's direction. I mean, God has already spoken many years earlier that he's going to be king. But unlike Saul, David is not presumptuous. And unlike Saul, David has a working relationship with the Lord. Not only does he ask God if he should go up, but he asks him where he should go. God tells David to go to Hebron. The men of Judah come voluntarily to anoint him as their king. David knows a man's gift makes way for him, which is a proverb that Solomon will write down later. A man's gift makes way for him. If we will trust the Lord, our gift will cause us to rise. Then David reaches out to honor the men of Jabesh-Gilead, and I covered that issue there. All right, so David sent messengers to the men of Jabesh-Gilead and said to them, may you be blessed by the Lord because you have shown this kindness to Saul your Lord and have buried him. And now may the Lord show you mercy and truth to you, and I will show you this goodness to you because you have done this thing. Now therefore let your hands be strong and be valiant, for Saul your Lord is dead, and also the house of Judah has anointed me king over them. 2 Samuel 2:8. But Abner the son of Ner, which is sort of obvious, it's Abner, son of Ner. The commander of Saul's army had taken Ishbosheth, the son of Saul, and brought him over to Mahanaim, and he made him king over Gilead, over the Asherites, over Jezreel, over Ephraim, over Benjamin, over all of Israel. Abner was Saul's general. They were related, they were family members. He was a Benjamite. And when David starts to emerge as king, immediately there's some political realities. Up until this time, under Saul, the people of Benjamin have been getting the choice jobs, and they have been close confidants, and all of the booty trickles down to them. And it includes the fact that Abner was his general with all the status and stature thereof. David has his own general, Joab, his uncle, and or cousin, I forget right now, but he has his own general. And he's towards the tribe of Judah. And Abner knows that he is not likely to be highly rewarded in the house of David. So he finds it in his best interest to go establish a successor to King Saul. And he finds a son who was named Ishbosheth. And he sets him up as the puppet king. Ishbosheth, Saul's son, was 40 years old. He became king over Israel, and he was king for 2 years. The house of Judah, however, followed David. At that time, David was king in Hebron over the house of Judah 7 years and 6 months. So, I think I covered this. Yeah, well, I'll cover some of that. There's some information there. Abner had a long history with David, some of it good, some not so good. Abner was the one who introduced victorious young David to Saul after David had slain Goliath. Abner could have found David's military ascendancy troubling. I covered that, I think. It was Abner that David chided for failing to protect Saul when David snuck into Saul's camp and took the spear and the water jug. Remember that? We talked about that. David already had a general, his own nephew, thank you, Joab, leaving Abner in no acceptable place in David's army. So his support of Ishbosheth as the new king ensured that he would continue to lead the army of Israel, which is the 10 northern tribes. Abner functioned as a military governor over Israel for 5.5 years, during which time he led Israel in a war against the Philistines. Then he set up as king over Israel Ishbosheth, Saul's son. Ishbosheth ruled Israel for 2 years in exile from Mahanaim in Gilead, a town east of the Jordan. It had a long history as a spiritual fortress. Jacob was once supported there by an army of angels as he waited for Esau. Remember that story? Mahanaim is later used by David as a fortress against Absalom when he has that issue. David waited patiently for God to give him the kingdom of Israel. He reigns contentedly over Judah only for 7 years and 6 months. David does not push his own agenda or leverage his own way. David only did what he saw his father, God, doing. What does that sound like? Sound like what Jesus said, I only do what I see my father doing. He lets God exalt him or bring him down as God sees fit. Again, David knows that a man's gift makes ways for him. Psalm 75:6 says, for promotion cometh neither from the east, nor from the west, nor from the south, but God is the judge. And he putteth down one, and he setteth up another. You know, we've talked a lot about the fact that if we have any grace in our life, if we have any goodness, if we are a people who love God and are walking with God, and we're Christian people, and we know many, many things about the Lord, and we do well much of the time, that the reason that is so is because of God's gracious revelation to us, not because we're made of better clay than the next person. The fact that we have success in an area, like to live righteously, or whatever area it is, should basically humble us at the grace of God to give us such a gift. So, you know, when we pray, when I pray, I thank God for all the stuff we have, and we have a lot. But I thank Him mostly for revelation, the fact that He has revealed something to me or in me. And David, you know, kept this in mind. Instead of feeling like he was made of better clay or he had all his credentials, which he did, and therefore trying to establish himself, he let God establish him and raise him up and whatever. Now, it wasn't that he was passive. He was very actively involved in all this process, but he didn't push or strive or shove. He let God do it. I do what I see my father doing. He knew that promotion comes neither from the east to the west, but God putteth down one and setteth up another. 2 Samuel 2. Now Abner the son of Ner went out from Mahanaim to Gibeon with the servants of Ishbosheth the son of Saul. Joab the son of Zeruiah, the servants of David, went out and met them by the pool of Gibeon. And they sat down on one side of the pool and the other side of the pool. Then Abner said to Joab, now let the young men rise and hold a contest before us. So this is David's general with his young bucks, and Abner's general with his young bucks, and they come together in a place for a kind of a friendly or not so friendly sporting event. So Joab said, let it happen, let them rise. So they rose and went over by count, 12 for Benjamin and Ishbosheth, the son of Saul, and 12 for the servants of David. Each one of them seized his opponent by the head and thrust his sword into his opponent's side, so they fell down together. It's kind of like jousting, only with sharp weapons.
What?
Killing each other?
Yeah. Well, they're warriors, and there's no battle, you know. So it's war games. Yeah. Remember, these are not 21st century people with Judeo-Christian sensitivities. Okay. Therefore, the place was called Helkath Hazarim, which is in Gibeon. That day the battle was very severe, and Abner the son, the men of Israel, were beaten before the servants of David. So the struggle for preeminence in Israel was more of a battle between the egos of two generals than it was any concern of David's. The two generals brought their troops together. I talked about this, whatever. What started as a barbecue with military games, 12-on-12, turned into a full-fledged battle between two armies, and Joab's men defeated Abner's men in conflict. combat. Now, the three sons of Zeruiah were there. That's Joab, Abishai, and Asahel. These are David's nephews, and these are three brothers. And they're high up in David's, you know, Joab is his general, and his two brothers are high up with him. Asahel was swift-footed as one of the gazelles in the field. And Asahel pursued Abner and did not turn to the right or to the left following Abner. So Abner looked behind him and he said, "Is that you, Asahel?" And he said, "It is I." And Abner said, "Well, turn to your right or turn to your left and take hold of one of the young men for yourself and take for yourself his spoil." In other words, don't follow me. But Asahel was not willing to turn aside from following him. And Abner repeated again to Asahel, "Turn aside from following me. Why should I strike you to the ground? How then could I lift up my face to your brother Joab?" Don't do this, boy. I'll have to kill you. However, he refused to turn aside, and therefore Abner struck him in the belly with the butt end of a spear so that the spear came out of his back. Now, that's a pretty good shove. And he fell down there, and he died on the spot. And it came about that all who came to the place where Asahel had fallen and died stood still. Asahel refused to quit chasing Abner because he wanted a noteworthy scalp on his belt. Abner tried to stop him with the butt end of his spear, incapacitating Asahel without killing him. But his charge was so fierce, the butt end penetrated him and he died. Which created immediate bad blood between Joab and Abishai, which later proved to be problematic in David's goals. Joab and Abishai pursued Abner, and when the sun was going down, they came to the hill of Ammah, which is in front of Gia, the way of the wilderness of Gibeon. The sons of Benjamin gathered together toward behind Abner, became one band, and they stood on the top of a certain hill. Then Abner called to Joab and said, "Shall the sword devour forever? Do you not know that it will be bitter in the end? How long will you refrain from telling the people to turn back from following their brothers?" And Joab said, "As God lives, if you had not spoken, surely then the people would have gone away in the morning, each following his own brother." But Joab blew the trumpet, and all the people halted and pursued Israel no longer. And they did not continue the fight anymore. Comments? There's a struggle here for power, and it's at all kinds of levels. And we see the behaviors of some men versus the behaviors of others, David in particular. Abner's men went through the Arabah all that night, so they crossed the Jordan and walked all morning. They came to Mahanaim. And then Joab returned from following Abner when he had gathered all the people together. 19 of David's servants besides Asahel were missing. So they lost 20 men in the battle. The servants of David had struck down many of Benjamin's and Abner's men, so that 360 men had died. They took up Asahel and they buried him in his father's tomb, which is in Bethlehem. And Joab and his men went all night until the day dawned at Hebron. Had to go tell David what they did. The cost of the Battle of Egos was 20 dead for Joab and 360 for Abner of Benjamin. This kind of tribal strife and ego-based competition cost David many opportunities to make peace and consolidate his throne. Moral is, you've got to keep an eye on the generals. All they know how to do is make war. They have little expertise or much interest in peace. So obviously a generalization, but we're talking about generals, so I guess that's okay.
Good to know in our society as well that the politicians
might
have to keep an eye on the general.
Yeah. Well, I think that's what Kennedy made a point of saying, and it may have cost him his life. Now, there was a long war between the house of Saul and the house of David. David grew steadily stronger, but the house of Saul grew weaker continually. Sons were born to David at Hebron. His first son was Amnon by Ahinoam the Jezreelitess, and his second son Kileab by Abigail the widow of Nabal the Carmelite. The third, Absalom the son of Maacah, the daughter of Talmai, king of Geshur. The fourth, Adonijah the son of Haggith. The fifth, Shephatiah, the son of Abital. The sixth, Yithream by David's wife Eglah, and they were born to David at Hebron. So he's ruling in Judah, growing his family. He's got six wives, they're all bearing him sons. And the seeds of future strife are growing right up in his midst. Too many mothers, not enough father is the problem. Now, once again, we've got mothers in competition that their son would replace him. and we're going to see all of that as, unfold as we go along. Sons are being prepared from the time they are very, very small to find a way to win the throne for the sake of everybody who's associated with them in the family, including their mothers. As we study the history of Israel, we're going to see that there very often there are some queen mothers that rise up and basically take over the throne, usually for ill, in various of the thrones. Like Eli and Samuel before him, David preaches to the whole world while his children go to hell. I'm sure it must be very hard to be a king and have, gosh, what, Solomon had 700 wives and 300 concubines, and have any hope whatsoever to actually raise a son. We know, for instance, in the days of Isaiah, that Uzziah had a son, Jotham, and Jotham had a son, Ahaz. Ahaz had a son named Hezekiah. And Ahaz's cousin was Isaiah. He was a member of the royal family. And what usually happened is that some royal son, or any nobleman's son, would be given a tutor that would carry him through. And Hezekiah's tutor was Isaiah. And we see that what happens is that whoever gets the throne, or when they come to the throne or power, or whatever, what they do is largely determined by who it was that discipled them, who it was that raised them. And almost never is it a father and his own son. It's just stacked against them. They're incredibly busy. They've got way too many sons. They've got way too many wives. But it creates all manner of problems. And from it, we can see, for instance, some of the wisdom of monogamy as opposed to polygamy. We can see that, you know, we have the benefit in a home like that to spend more time with our children, etc., etc. But there's problems here that are developing right under his nose. Now, Saul had a concubine whose name was Rizpah, the daughter of Aiah. And Ishbosheth said to Abner, "Why have you gone into my father's concubine?" And Abner was very angry at the words of Ishbosheth and said, "Am I a dog's head that belongs to Judah? Today I show kindness to the house of Saul, your father, and his brothers. His friends have not delivered you into the hands of David, yet today you charge me with guilt concerning a woman." Now, one of the political realities in royal houses is that kings' wives and concubines, and this is true even into late Middle Ages. It's actually true even in modern times at some level. But kings' wives and concubines become tools or pawns in the political game. So what happened is when a king comes along, very often he will marry one of the wives or concubines of the previous king to help establish his throne. So when Absalom took over David's throne by force, it was a coup de grace, and David fled, the people were having a hard time deciding whether to follow Absalom or not, because they knew that David and Absalom were having a father-son spat. And if they get all behind Absalom and whatever, get all bowed up, and then David and Absalom work it out, now they got problems with David. And so David had a very shrewd counselor named Ahithophel, but he sided with Absalom, and he was wicked and bright. And so he told Absalom, if you want the people to follow you, you've got to demonstrate to them that you will never be able to make it up with your father. And so he encouraged him to take 10 of David's concubines up on the roof of a house and bed them publicly for everybody to see, so that everybody knew that it was kaput between Absalom and David. King Henry VIII was required to marry his older brother Arthur's wife because of the treaty between Spain or Portugal, whatever it is, Spain, I guess, and England. And it was not uncommon. You know, Queen Victoria, these people all had these arranged marriages, and they're usually the houses of Europe all married together. And so there's a lot of political stuff around these marriages. Ishbosheth, Abner has taken a fancy to one of Saul's concubines, and he's taken her as a concubine, which is a sort of a wife junior. So it's a legal position, but it's Well, what it means is your children have no inheritance, but you are a wife. Concubine, it comes from the Latin words, which means concubinage, with bed rights. It just means with bed rights. So this is a legal wife, but no inheritance rights, just with bed rights. Remember that in the Bible, if two people are married and they commit adultery, the penalty is supposed to be death. But if two unmarried people come together and sexually, then the penalty for that is marriage, because because consummation is marriage, and it was clearly understood that was the case. Now, down through the years, that's been used many times to the benefit of some young princess or prince who doesn't want to marry the gal from Germany with the face like a sow. You know, that he's got to marry politically. He just winds up getting caught in bed with his girlfriend, and that they can't do nothing about that. That was the case, for instance, when Jacob and his sons and his wives and his daughter Dinah came to Shechem, and Shechem's king Hamor had a son whose name was Shechem. The town was probably named after him. And Shechem, the son, fell in love with Dinah just from afar, and she didn't mind either. And so what happened is that he took her to bed. There's no implication that she fought that off. And so what happened is that they wound up being married because of consummation. Now, Jacob could have taken his daughter and gone and left them, whatever, but she would be, in effect, ruined for, you know, forever having a family or anything because of the cultures. So that was just an example of the young prince marrying the girl he wants, daughter of a shepherd, rather than who would probably be picked for him, which is the niece of somebody in a kingdom two doors over. So Absalom wants to marry Rizpah, who is one of Saul's concubines. Now, Ishbosheth sees this as a political assault because she was Saul's concubine. He says he is seeing this that you are you're positioning yourself to take the throne. Now, Abner has ruled over Israel for 5 years, and then he sets in as king the son of Saul, Ishbosheth. So he's a propped up king, there's no doubt about that. But Ishbosheth, is when he sees Saul marry this girl, thinks that it's a maneuver that he's using to get rid of him and his household. One of the things that happens when kings turn over is a lot of people die, and people who are on the wrong side get eliminated, exiled, if it's a good day. So, yeah.
I just wanted to ask you, if they consummated the marriage, I mean, if they had consummation and they were considered marriage, was that cultural or was that God's rule?
Well, it was both.
Both?
Yeah. I mean, yeah, because God's rule is that consummation equals marriage.
Okay.
There was nobody calling for anybody to be stoned. That what was called for is a bride price was to be paid and all this sort of thing, you know. Okay. We have a tendency to look at these biblical customs and whatever and read them from the light of our own culture. And remember that much of right and wrong is culturally derived. So, for instance, I have friends, one in particular in Swaziland, who is a very good Christian man, that's polygamous. And there are many Christians in Africa who are polygamous because they have no prohibition against it. They don't see it. You know, the Bible doesn't, nowhere says that it's wrong. It's culture that says, you know, we can't do this anymore. Paul says in the New Testament that if a man's going to be a bishop, he has to be the husband of one wife. In other words, he can't be polygamous. Because, you know, getting back to what we said, Paul says, you can barely manage your own household and the church, much less several, households in the church. So, no, God, remember, progressive revelation. God is, he's certainly not, he's fine with this as it goes. But anyway, so Abner sees this as political, and he's complained. And he's livid because he is politically innocent. He has no, he has secured Ishbosheth's throne. He doesn't want it for his sons. And Ishbosheth has accused him over a woman. Abner threatens to give the kingdom to David, and Ishbosheth becomes fearful because he knows he's merely the puppet. Then Abner sent messengers to David in his place, saying, "Whose is the land? Make your covenant with me, and behold, my hand shall be with you to bring all of Israel over to you." And he said, "Good, I will make covenant with you, but I demand one thing of you, namely that you shall not see my face unless you first bring Michal, Saul's daughter, when you come to see me." So David sent messengers to Ishbosheth, Saul's son, saying, "Give me my wife Michal, whom I have betrothed for 100 foreskins of the Philistines." And Ishbosheth sent and took her from her husband, from Paltiel, son of Laish. But her husband went with her, weeping as he went, and followed her as far as Baharim. Then Abner said to him, "Go return." So he returned. Now, remember this story. Michal, David was promised Saul's firstborn daughter, her oldest daughter, as a wife for killing Goliath. Whoever killed Goliath was going to get her. And when David killed Goliath, he turned out to be sort of not marriageable yet. And because Saul wasn't anticipating that a boy was going to get the prize. So Merab, who did not like David at all, and David didn't like Merab, she wound up going to someone else. But when David came of age, Saul, mostly for political reasons, reminded David that he'd been promised a daughter. And David and Michal were heavy. They liked each other a bunch. They were lovers. They weren't lovers, but they were in love with each other. So Saul gives Michal to David as his wife, thinking that she will be a spy in his household so that he can control what's going on. But Michal sides with David. In fact, she helps him against her father, and for which she gets soundly rebuked. When David flees from Saul and open warfare goes on, Saul gives Michal to one of his generals, Paltiel, and she becomes his wife. And you have to remember the culture. It wasn't like women had a lot of choice. So she becomes his wife. Over the years, she has children with Paltiel, and they develop a relationship. They love each other. When David becomes, when Abner offers the kingdom to David, he says, "You've got to give me back Michal, or I'm not even going to talk about it." Once again, it's a political move. If he has Michal, he has Saul's daughter. Now, there's no indication that they ever had any kind of relationship whatsoever. After she was brought home, she was hostile. And we see her later on rebuking David publicly for his worship of the Lord. And we see that she was bitter. We're told that she was bitter, whatever. So this is a political thing. I'm glad you asked. I am. I'm certainly glad you asked. Because it's an honest question. It's the question that everybody who reads with any kind of integrity wants to know. And the answer to this question is what's called progressive revelation. When God first starts dealing with man, he's dealing with Adam and Eve, and they're very, very high-end moral creatures with a lot of intellect and whatever. But when Adam and Eve fall, they deteriorate down to the caveman. They become, their descendants become the caveman. And then you got Noah's flood. And in the process of that deterioration, they get into all kinds of things. And the main reason that God destroyed the men was because of the violence. They were obviously sexually perverted and all that. But it's because of the violence. They'd gotten so violent that he wiped them out to start over. Well, once Noah comes out of the boat, we have a generation or two of peace with God along those lines. But then the fallen nature of man continues on, whatever. And so we get to the place where God has to interrupt the process with the Tower of Babel because He's agreed not to start over again. In fact, he offers to Moses later, twice, that he can start over with Moses just for Israel. So what happens is God scatters them by spreading their language and whatever. God has to take this fallen man, this caveman, these people with these very fallen nature, and they're all of their twisted and bentness. He has to take those people and try to somehow or another bring them to the place where they can relate to God. And it's not easy because they are miles and miles away from even being able to appreciate anything about God. So what happens is God begins to reveal himself progressively. to them. So what happens is he doesn't sweat some things, because right now he's trying to teach them other things that are more important. For instance, God doesn't say to them that there is only one God until the 8th century prophets. So Moses is writing in 1400 B.C., and Noah is back at 2500 B.C. Noah is personally about the fact that there's one God. But the world has come to believe that there are multiple gods, and God doesn't bother to correct them forcefully until the 8th century, because he's had too much to do. He's had to bring them forward to even be able to understand that. You have to get them to a certain level before they can understand the next level stuff. So God tolerates and puts up with all manner of things. Now, he tolerates and puts up with a lot in us. And someday, we're going to be sitting up there going, man, how did he ever put up with that? We wouldn't even think of doing stuff like we do now. And we are, by our own standards, far more enlightened than the people before us. You know what I'm saying? So, God just can't take... Okay, in the 60s, it was considered chic for a woman to smoke. We had a culture, this is close back as the 60s, where many things were considered to be right and moral and good and whatever, and we've come to believe that they're not because of further revelation. Like, for instance, the fact that the tobacco kills you and all that sort of thing. So even we operate in progressive revelation. And if we take our present standards of behavior and we judge generations 2, 3, 4 back, it's really unfair because they don't have the progressive revelation that we do to get us here. For instance, in 1865, the preachers in many churches, especially in the South, were preaching from the Bible that slavery was God's will. And they believed it. They believed it. Now, we don't think they should have, because we see clearly. We think that's just ridiculous that they should believe that. But, you know, they were serious as a heart attack. They believed it. And what happened is that God has shown us more about that. Now, here's another example. We live in a Judeo-Christian world. And therefore, we have some values that are typical of the Judeo-Christian world. One of them, for instance, is we respect our children and a number of other things. Well, if you go to cultures around us today in the world that are not Judeo-Christian, they have a whole different set of values about some of the things that we value. They're pre-Christian. They're pre-Judeo-Christian. And therefore, they don't have the revelation that we have. And that's why they find it easy to, you know, strap bombs on their children and send them out to blow them up. But, you know, that's why they think it's just fine, for instance, to back a car over their daughter because she was caught dating a white guy. You know, I mean, a non-Arab guy. You know what I'm saying? So I actually have a thing I've written on progressive revelation that does a sort of a better job of systematically laying it out. And why don't I send it to you? But the answer to this question is progressive revelation, and it's an important one. When we look back and we see what all God tolerated, allowed, whatever, or in some cases even told him to do, he's operating within the cultural understanding, and he can only move it so far, so fast. He can't move it. So, for instance, when he goes to Sinai, he brings the people to Sinai after miraculously delivering them out of Egypt, quite demonstrably bringing them out of Egypt, whatever. At the foot of Sinai, he appears to them, his voice resonates to them from the top of Sinai. And so he makes himself known to them at that particular point in time. They are scared by that, so they ask him not to do that. They ask him to speak to Moses. But nonetheless, they see the presence of God. And so he begins to educate these slaves who have this Abraham and Isaac and Jacob background, but haven't been real solid followers of the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob for probably 100 years or so. Because, you know, when they came into the land 400 years before the Exodus, they were followers of Jacob's God. But as time goes on and circumstances go on, they drift. That's why they had such a hard time relating to Moses when he tried to encourage them to believe and trust and all that sort of thing. So he brings them to Sinai, and when he brings them to Sinai, he begins to teach them. So he starts off, for instance, with, here's 10 commandments. These are things, I'm here to show you what you should or shouldn't do. And they're going, what? I can't kill the guy who killed my brother? You know, I don't get that. So he's these are things that are simple to us. And then he gives them 613 rules and regs, half of which are do's and half of which are don'ts, some of which are humorous, as you remember. about Lefty. Anyway, so the point is that he gives them these guidelines as a tutor. Paul says the law was a tutor. And Paul says that before the law came, there wasn't as much sin, but when the law came, sin abounded. Well, the reason there wasn't much sin is because they didn't know it was wrong. Okay? A really good example is the issue of lex talionis, the law of retaliation. In the culture before that time, and in the same cultures today that are pre-Christian, pre-Judeo-Christian, if someone killed you, a member of your family, then you would go out and kill him, his dog, his cat, his wife, his nephews, and whoever else you could find. And they were honor-bound to come and kill all of yours. And so we have this whole thing back and forth. And when Moses came along, Moses, who we have a tendency to look back on as sort of harsh, you know, sort of legal, whatever. Moses came along and became the great liberal. Moses said, from this point on, it'd be an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. So you cannot punish anybody beyond the severity of the crime. So if I put out your eye, then I have to give you an eye. And by the way, in every case that we ever see, no one ever put out an eye. It was then turned into a monetary value. It's the beginning of tort law. So I owe you an eye, and the eye is 10 oxen and whatever. That's what it is. That's the way it actually worked. So Moses, when he said an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, he's saying lex talionis has got to stop. Jeremiah, the prophet, says to the people in the 8th century, from this point on, God is not going to judge families by the sins of one person. That people will be judged for their own sins and not for the sins of... We're not going to have this group thing. That was the common culture of the day. When they cross over into Jericho and the one guy takes the loot he was not supposed to take because it was dedicated to God, and he hides it, and then they take it up the next day and they go to the Battle of Ai and they lose, and they can't figure out why they lost, and it's because somebody violated the covenant. So they figure out who all it was, and they bring it forward, and the guy finally confesses the whole thing. And so the punishment is they take him, his wife, dogs, cats, and whatever, and they stone them all to death and build a big rock pile over them, whatever. Because the cultural understanding was, is one, you know, one gets punished, they all get punished. So we have, it is our level of revelation that makes us say, well, that's bad. That's, you ask, if you go to certain countries in the Middle East and you ask the holiest man there, is it okay for a guy to kill the man who raped his daughter? He said, of course. Of course it is. It's absolutely okay. Because that's what he believes. That's what he thinks to be true. And without the revelation, you know, what can you do about it? So our understanding of what's right or wrong comes to us more by revelation than it does because it's intrinsically true in many cases about many things. Does that help at all?
Yeah. Not to belabor the point, but I know you pray for the country all the time.
Yeah.
When you look at progressive revelation, but then you look at recidivism,
yeah,
where are we in relationship to 100 years ago, faith-wise?
Well, we're not as good as we were 100 years ago. Our forefathers, let's put it this way, this is demonstrable. Not only did we have a better relationship with God as a country, you know, there's always in every age good people, bad people, really bad people, whatever. But as a country, we had more people with a good working relationship with God. And that was reflected in our public observances. So, you know, for instance, we still had the Ten Commandments on the wall. People swore on a Bible, all this kind of stuff. And even if some people had quit believing in the efficacy of all that, those things represented who our culture was. Now what's happening is people are coming out and saying, we need to get rid of all of these sort of public demonstrations of God because they don't represent us anyway. So, you know, that in itself represents evidence that we're not where our culture was 100 years ago. And if we, you know, when you look at what happened historically, and when we get to studying kings and whatever, what we're going to see is that when Israel was faithful to God, he blessed them, lifted them up, whatever. When they ran away from God, down they went. The currency was, they were attacked by enemies, plagues came in, their currency fell apart, you know, that sort of thing. And where we're at right now is that we were handed a covenantal relationship that we either nurture or abandon. And to the degree that we abandon it, we set ourselves up for what happens when people abandon the covenant of God. What happened to his own people, Israel, and everybody else. So even like the Amorites, when the Lord sent in Israel to wipe out the Amorites, remember the Amorites had 400 years to repent before the Lord, because they all came out of Noah. They had the Amorites were people that God had worked with for 400 years to try to do the right thing, and they got to the place where they said, no and hell no. And so, you know, so God took them out. We're very much at risk here about what's going to happen to us as a people, as a culture, as a country, based on how we behave going forward in terms of our relationship with God. And remember, the covenant is God first and love our neighbor. I mean, one of the biggest single ways it shows up is how badly we mistreat our neighbor. You know, I mean, gosh, we're paying for the sins of the 1860s still to this very day in spades. Like prior to the end of World War II, all welfare, all education, and all health care was done by private people, churches, religious groups, and local communities. And it wasn't until after World War II that we developed a Department of Health, Education, and Welfare. So the government takes it, and we let them do it because it seems like a good way to go. They can't manage it because they don't have a skill set for it. You know, that'd be like asking me to have the next three babies in our household. They don't have a skill set for it. They were never designed for it. And so they do it very badly, and then it becomes a place of corruption, whatever. Meanwhile, the people are not being taken care of because they do it badly. So when we abandon our responsibility to care for our neighbor, and we abandon our calling to put God first, then we're abandoning the covenant. And as we do that more and more systematically, it becomes wider spread. Is that okay? I mean, I probably said too much, but okay. That's a good question. It's an important question. And if anybody wants that progressive revelation thing, we'll email it out to you. I recommend it to you if that's your question. Okay. Well, we'll send it to class list. Because what I do there is not just this sort of brief blurb I just went through, but I lay out scripture and whatever to support the point. And we'll go forward here. So, let's see, we were talking about Michelle. Where am I, folks? What do you think? So David sent messengers to Ishbosheth, Saul's son, saying, give me my wife Michal, to whom I was betrothed for 100 foreskins of the Philistines. And Ishbosheth sent and took her from her husband, from Pealtiel, the son of Laish. But her husband went with her, and weeping as he went. All that sort of thing. All right, 17. Now Abner had consultation with the elders of Israel, saying, in times past you were seeking for David to be king over you. Now then, do it. For the Lord has spoken of David, saying, by the hand of my servant David, I will save my people, Israel, from the hand of the Philistines, from the hand of all their enemies. Abner also spoke in the hearing of Benjamin, Abner went to speak to the hearing of David in Hebron, all that seemed good to Israel and the whole house of Benjamin. Then Abner and the 20 men with him came to David at Hebron, and David made a feast for Abner and the men who were with him. And Abner said to David, let me arise and go and gather all Israel to my lord the king, that they may make a covenant with you, that you may be king over all your soul desires. So David sent Abner away, and he went in peace. So Abner has brokered a deal where all the people of Israel are willing to accept David. Remember, these are people who've always admired David, no matter what tribe they're in, for various reasons. Remember, this was the David of whom it was said, Saul has killed his thousands and David his 10,000s. He was popular. He was well known. He was the guy who killed Goliath. He was thought of as a good man. And now that the politics are out of the way concerning Saul's house, Abner has brokered this deal. Happy days are here again, right? Not so. When Joab and all the army that was with him arrived, they told Joab, saying, Abner, the son of Ner, came to the king, and he has sent him away, and he's gone in peace. Then Joab said to the king and said, "What have you done? Behold, Abner came to you. Why then have you sent him away and he is already gone? You know Abner the son of Ner, that he came to deceive you and to learn of your going out and coming in and to find out all that you are doing." Joab hates Abner for killing his brother, Asahel. Joab knows that Abner is competition for his job as David's general. Abner's payment for giving the kingdom to David was naturally that Abner become the second in David's command. Joab is not about to let that happen, especially to Abner, his adversary. When Joab came out from David, he sent messengers after Abner, and they brought him back from the well of Sirah, but David did not know it. So when Abner returned to Hebron, Joab took him aside in the middle of the gate to speak with him privately, and there he struck him in the belly so that he died on account of the blood of his brother, Asahel, his brother. And afterwards, when David heard of it, he said, "I and my kingdom are innocent before the Lord forever for the blood of Abner the son of Ner. May it fall on the head of Joab and all his father's house, and may there not fail from the house of Joab one who has a discharge, who is a leper, who takes a hold of a staff, or who falls by the sword, who lacks bread." So Joab and Abishai, his brother, killed Abner because he put their brother Asahel to death, battle of Gibeon. Then David said to Joab and all the people with him, "Tear your clothes and gird on sackcloth and lament before Abner." King David walked behind the bier, and they buried Abner in Hebron. And the king lifted up his voice, and he wept at the grave of Abner. And all the people wept, and the king chanted a lament for Abner, saying, "Should Abner die as a fool dies, your hands were not bound, nor your feet put in fetters. As one falls before the wicked, you have fallen." So David makes a public display of that he's innocent of this, and that he grieves for Abner, because he considers Abner to be an honest broker. And this issue now spreads, and it's only finally dealt with when Solomon becomes king. We'll get to that eventually. Joab misrepresents David to Abner in a plot to kill him. When Joab sees what Joab's done, he's appalled on several levels. First, it's a particularly bloodthirsty and treacherous thing to do. And second, it is devastating to David's plans to become king of all Israel. Now, we've talked before about the fact that David's theology is higher than average in his lifetime. He believed in afterlife, and he understood things about God that were better or higher or more sophisticated than a lot of people. And one of the things that he sensed about this was, this is just treacherous and wrong. Whereas somebody like Joab, he would say, all's fair in love and war, you know. It's just the way it's done. It's almost like Abner and his people are the mafia, and who have a cult of their own, a culture of their own, and a way to behave. He tries to distance himself politically from Joab's deed. He publicly curses Joab and his household for this treachery. He publicly demands that all of his people tear their clothes as a sign of their grief and mourning for Abner. David walks behind the bier when Abner is buried and wept openly and loudly at Abner's grave. Ever the minstrel, David sings a personal lament for Abner, in which he honors Abner and calls Joab a wicked man. He is angry over the political damage, but he's also generally appalled and shocked over Joab's actions, his ethics, and his morality. David is a warrior and wants to be king, but he wants it righteously and as a gift from God. And all the people wept again over him, and all the people came to persuade David to eat bread while he was still David. David vowed, saying, "May God do so to me and more also, if I taste bread or anything else before the sun goes down." And all the people took note of it, and it pleased them, just as everything the king did pleased all the people. So all the people in Israel understood that day that it had not been the will of the king put Abner the son of Ner to death. And the king said to his servants, "Do you not know that a prince and a great man has fallen this day in Israel? I am weak today, though anointed king. These men, the sons of Zerah, are too difficult for me. May the Lord repay the evildoer according to his evil." Comments. I mean, this is, you know, it's all fair in love and war. Comments. This is, I mean, John's right. This is not the way we behave or think. It's not the way we would expect the people of God to behave or think. It is how the culture is. It's how the culture has only come back from the fall this far. It's only come back this far. And if they weren't Israel, they wouldn't. The people outside of Israel, they hadn't come back that far. What basically God did was, He reached down into the earth and he took for himself a people. And he made a covenant relationship with that people. And in that people, like an ark, he poured his knowledge, understanding, and wisdom. And his culture, his way of thinking. And he required them to walk in that, to teach it to their children. Deuteronomy 6 says, concerning the Torah, he said, "You shall teach this to your children diligently. When you rise up in the morning, and when you lay down at night, and when you eat with them at the table, and when you walk with them along the way." So if you consider that most children worked their father's side in those days, that meant that the father was supposed to, and mother was supposed to demonstrate to their children, first thing in the morning, last thing at night, at meals, and along the way, how to live before the Lord. So that God could create a people in the earth who were that much more enlightened than all the others. Now, there is a plan in God that when we get to a certain time, that's going to expand out to others. Many people came and joined Israel for this very reason. There were a lot of people in Israel who were not Jews. They were proselytes. They were aliens, but they became Jewish. There were people we'll see in David's court who were Philistines and Edomites and people from other cultures, because the culture of Israel, though as rugged as it was to us, was way ahead of where the world was in terms of its culture and values. Now, out in the world, you had some good people, because there's always good people. There's always people who instinctively understand what's right or wrong. They can see that this is right or wrong. And there were good people like that, and God interfaced with people like that. A good example is the man named Job. Job was known as the most righteous man in the East. Abraham was the most righteous man in the West, and they were contemporaries. Job wasn't in the line of Abraham at all. He came out of Noah, he came out of Japheth. And he and his people were living, I forgot. But anyway, they were living way away from where Israel was and where God was doing all this stuff with Israel. But they were still walking with the Lord, because that particular strain that got to Job had maintained the teachings of Noah and the stuff that went on. When Abraham was a child, like all the children who lived in Ur of the Chaldees, he would have been brought to school, which was done at the city gate. Typically, they would gather the children around the city gate, and typically the elders would teach them. That's what older people did. There was a kind of exchange. The older people taught their wisdom to the young people. And they would teach them things like the Toledots. They would start off with genealogies. This guy begot this guy, this guy begot this guy. And then once the kids learned the genealogies, then they would hang information on it like a Christmas tree. So for instance, we read in early part of Genesis that it was during the reign, it was during the life of this man, during one of those begots, you know, and it said, and it was during his life that they discovered iron. It was during this life that they started having church services. I mean, it says that as you go on. So that's how they would teach them. So what happened is that whatever your village elders knew or learned or believed, that's what your children learned and believed, whatever was supported by your parents. Abraham had the benefit of sitting in a village, or the Chaldees, whose oldest living member was Noah. So the elder that taught Abraham, of course he taught everybody, was Noah. And Noah had two brothers and a father who were, Abraham had two brothers and a father who were pagans and idol worshippers. But it stuck with Abraham. It stuck with him. And he began to seek God and find him until God began to speak to him. And Abraham followed a voice. I mean, Abraham never laid eyes on God or anything representing God until many, many years later when God comes to dinner on the way to go stomp out whatever, but Sodom and Gomorrah. But he followed a voice and took his people away from the comfort and security of the tribe out to start something different. Abraham was the oldest son. He would have been king over Haran, the city where they were. And he left all of that to follow the voice. Now, his nephew Lot went with him because Haran, Lot's father, had died and Abraham had fathered him, whatever. But that's who went out. And he basically carried that knowledge of God with him to what was basically Canaan. And then, of course, he passed it on to Isaac, who passed it on to Jacob. Jacob's people, they wind up in Egypt, they go to Sinai, and there you go. That's the line. Well, there were other people who heard the voice of God and walked in the voice of God who were not in Israel. Because the Bible is a kind of a, frozen section. Like if you stick a tube through the ice in the Arctic, you pull it up and you lay it all out, you get these pieces. The Bible is a straight line that runs from Adam to Jesus. History is his story. And it basically covers that line. And it talks about people over here, but they drop off and are no longer covered. One of the things we see this in is when Moses flees from Egypt. Moses knows almost nothing about the Hebrew God. First of all, he's raised in an Egyptian court. He's been taught Egyptian things. We know that he had, as a infant, that his mother was his nursemaid, but we have no knowledge of him understanding anything about that at all. And beyond that, and certainly no educated or focused teaching about the things of Israel. Moses winds up at 40 years old, out in the land of Midian. He flees the desert, whatever. And there, he sort of figures he's done. He's done. He's over. He marries Zipporah, the daughter of Jethro, the priest in Midian. And she, you know, he's got 7 daughters, and we all know that story. Jethro is the one who teaches Moses about the God of Israel, the God of Isaac and Jacob and Abraham. Not, he didn't get that at Pharaoh's court. He got that from the priest of Midian. Now, the Midian and was one of 6 sons that, when Sarah died, Abraham married Keturah, a local girl. And she gave him 6 sons. And one of them was Midian. And the Midianite people kept the faith with Abraham's God all of those years, from Abraham to the time of Moses. So, you know, you're talking Isaac, you're talking 700-800 years at this point. And so even at that point, they were still walking with the knowledge and the revelation of all that. So it was Midian, the priest of, it was Jethro, a priest of Midian, who we would consider pagans in a way, that told him about the God of the mountain, the whole 9 yards. It was Jethro who came to visit him and gave him advice from God on how to handle the administration of all of this, which God backed. So we have the knowledge of God is carried from age to age by various people. And typically in any age that you can see or find, the people who walk with God are a remnant. I'm a remnant theologian, which means I believe, based on what I study and whatever, that in every age it's only a remnant of people who walk with God. That there are many, many people who are religious, but there's only a remnant who actually walk with the Lord. And what happens is in every age it passes down. Then the challenge becomes, for us, are we going to be people who pass it down? Or are we going to be people who abandon it and the generations after us abandon it? Here in the U.S., and I'll quit here, but here in the U.S. where we are is people before us passed it on to us. And they told us how we should behave. And not only the Torah, the official written rules and everything, but how to translate them, how to use them, how to walk in them. And it's up to us to pass it or not pass it down. And whether or not this country survives this next go-round or this particular thing is going to depend largely on that, whether or not a big enough remnant is here to keep the culture safe or go whole, or if it gets to be so small that it gets swamped. Comments? Yes?
You said that David is a prophet. He's a prophet because of his progressed revelation about how one should react.
Yeah, he's prophetic. Yeah, he writes, his Psalms are prophetic, yes.
Maybe even Abraham, because he had a relationship with God.
Well, yes, see, anybody who has a relationship with God, I mean, a prophet's an office, okay? And so anybody who has a relationship with God is a carrier of truth from one place to the other.
David seemed to have more than...
Yeah, he did. He was. Remember, there's Nathan. I mean, there's people around him who are appreciating what he's saying, whatever. It's just, it's not the bulk of the people. They're all affected by David. We'll see it when we get on down the line. Good kings create an environment where the people do well. And it shows up in things like bring bringing down all the high places and tearing down all the false god statues, and you know, like Josiah, who was the son of one of the worst kings that ever lived. And when he became king, they got to cleaning out the temple, which was a storage place at this point. And they found the book of the law, and they read it, and they went, "Holy cow, we are in trouble." And so they took it to the prophetess of the day that they trusted the most, which was a lady named Huldah. And she said, "This is it. This is it. You need to do this." And Josiah proclaimed, "We will live by this," and basically rearranged the whole of the culture, you know, for that purpose, because he found the truth there in the temple. So when the kings were good, the people walked with God. And when the kings were bad, the people turned away from God. And sometimes it took a generation, one way or the other. I'm gonna shut up. Any comments? Somebody pray us out. I don't want to go over long.